It is so great to be here today with Gabe and with Ryan. And I see Gabe's dog there in the background, so we might have a little visitor once in a while. And so Gabe and Ryan have both been on my show before, and they recently had an opportunity to meet each other. So I thought maybe we could start with Ryan explaining how that happened, how they met each other, and then what the connection is between their ideas, and then we'll get into some of those ideas as we go.
Cool. Thanks, Karen. Yeah, so pretty much, well, first you emailed me saying, hey, there's this guy that's also in the Dallas area. You know, he's been wanting to meet other people in this little corner, which is like kind of a new experience for me. I don't do a lot of this in person, you know. This is very much like an internet thing for me normally. But I was intrigued, and you know, it sounded like Gabe was kind of trying to start up an estuary, which is honestly kind of surprising that no one had already been doing this in this area, because this seems kind of like a perfect area for it, you know. And so when I heard what Gabe was doing, it's like, okay, cool, let's try this out. And I think there were like three or four of us, maybe five, at the first estuary meeting, and it was really good. It was just like, it's nice to like have coffee with other people who like these kinds of ideas. And it was like everyone was super energetic and like interested, and the conversation was just flowing really well. And so it was really cool. And I was really struck by a ton of similarities in what Gabe and I are doing, because, you know, Karen, I described to you in our last conversation that I've been working through kind of trying to simulate some of my ideas, or kind of formalize them, maybe like get a computer program that can represent them in some manner. And as I started describing this to Gabe, he started describing his own work, and I realized, like, wait, there's a lot of overlap here, because it felt like essentially what I was, the project that I've begun was almost like trying to map the patterns of cognition or consciousness, and for the purpose of being able to map how can broken networks heal, or how can networks transform, you know. And that comes from kind of my interest in like memory reconsolidation and that stuff, because I think where I'm heading at the moment is like, it seems like the patterns of transformation that you find in that whole memory reconsolidation thing are probably going to scale to minds of any scale, right? And so, you know, a lot of researchers are just doing it for the human mind. Like, how is it people can heal by activating two different parts of the network back and forth, and then, you know, combining them, you know. But it's like, it seemed like that pattern would scale up to networks the size of a family or a community or a world, you know. And when I started thinking about like, okay, memory reconsolidation applied to the internet, like that seems like an intriguing idea to me. And it seems like it would be the same pattern. And so anyway, when I came across what Gabe is doing, it's like, oh man, it's almost like he's following the same kinds of track, but he's like way further along. And I don't totally understand like his work yet, but it's triggering all these things in my mind. You know, like when I read Mathieu Peugeot's book, The Language of Creation, it just like fizzled my mind and made me like make all these connections. And I'm having the same experience talking with Gabe and looking at his work. And so I just wanted to talk, you know.
That sounds great. Yeah. I'm guessing that it not only scales all the way up, Ryan, but it also scales all the way down. The memory reconsolidation thing. Pretty sure that it would, if I stopped and thought about it long enough, and you know, Michael Levin's concept about the TAME, something, something mind everywhere. I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but he has this idea that even amongst cells, there is some sort of cognitive processing going on.
Interesting. Okay.
So I'm guessing that it not only scales all the way up, but it scales all the way down, because everything I've done in the last 4 years, as I've explored these ideas, is that they all scale all the way up and all the way down. So I don't think this one is going to be different.
And that's what's intriguing to me, I think, is like, it feels like things, I think what I've been excited about recently is this notion that like things are not arbitrary. And, you know, you and I have talked a lot about that pretty much in every one of our conversations. That's one of the themes, is, you know, realizing that, no, there's a structure to everything. And that structure is composed of patterns that scale up and down. And it seems as if those patterns scale all the way up and all the way down, you know. And so Gabe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean that's a lot of the kinds of things you're looking at. Like I know it's a model of cognition or like an architecture of cognition, but like are you envisioning it just for the human mind or for minds of any scale, or like what's your angle on it?
No, I definitely put it as the pattern because in my profile on my X account, my little phrase I have is carefully trying to thoroughly trace the pattern on the floor. And I think of the pattern on the floor as the one that's at the bottom, and it's also the one that continues all the way up to the top. So I'm very much in line with that way of thinking about it. And you mentioned Michael Levin's work, and I'm really intrigued with what he's doing and the this figuring out what the boundary is between what in my model would be body and form. So you're dealing with which is and body emerges kind of in between substance and form. So they're all related in that way. You see, it's not just the expression of genes with what Michael Levin is doing. It's the alteration of those electric fields and changing almost. It's not that it's another type entirely. It seems to be tweaking the form of the object as well, you know, giving a single-headed thing two heads. And it's not that it's some other type of head, it's the same type of head, but it's tweaking the form rather than the body of the thing in on a genetic level. So it's that's all really fascinating to me as far as how I think about these things based on the way I've modeled them. So all of that to me seems integrated. And as you said, all the way down to the bottom and all the way up to the top. Like I'm definitely in line with that. Even thinking in terms of Trinitarian theology and then down to the quantum level. Like I think those patterns are going to are rooted in what I would call the logos and the idea of Christ in creation, to go pretty hard in the biblical direction. But that pattern seems to permeate everything. And I think that's what the natural law is born out of, is the limits and the pathways and the ordering that is present in all things. And so that's
Well, so Gabe, let me use a question here to get us started at looking at. You had pointed me to pages 60 through 64 of your PDF document. And I'm not going to dig too hard into it. I'm going to let you do that. But at the very beginning, it says, how can we discover what is real? And then the subscript under that is establishing a Tao. TAO, establishing a Tao. So what do you mean when you say that this concept or this systematic breakdown of cognition is establishing a Tao?
I think I look at it in the sense because you think of C.S. Lewis's Tao when he talks about that. I think in the Abolition of Man, which has come up a lot in this little corner lately. A lot of C.S. Lewis seems to be going around right now, which I'm enjoying, and just that idea of that underlying order and that those absolutes and matters of truth. There's something underneath. So it's not that I'm established something. Establishing something new, and maybe establish wasn't the right word, but it is in the sense that I'm trying to establish my own understanding of the order that underlies everything. And so that's the relationship with the Tao. It's like what are the means, what are the tools that we have, what makes up our cognition, our experience, what are the different parts of it, and how do we move through it in order to map what is like. I think it's kind of because if you think of it in the sense, it's almost like you're looking at it's the difference of how things work versus how things are. So how things work is looking at the architecture of things, and how things are is looking more at how operations are going on as a result of navigating that space and using those tools that we've been given in our being to help us as Ryan was mentioning, help us adjust and change and grow. And those things to me seem to have an order as well. So it's, I think that's what I'm aiming at ultimately, is like, how can we understand that better in order to get closer to the truth, right? I think the best way I can put it in the moment.
And for me, it's exciting because I'm like, you know, the counselor part of me is like really interested in like, how is it people heal? And the prevailing wisdom right now is you just read the DSM and it's just chaos. It's like you have all these random diagnoses and there's no structure to it. There's no patterns really. It's just sort of like, here's a thing that happens and here's a thing that happens and here's what we found that fixes that and here's what we found that fixes that. And it's like, that feels so archaic to me. And like, like it's fundamentally rejecting the idea that there is actually order and purpose in things. It feels very materialistic to me. And my intuition, even though I can't really back it up with anything substantive at this point, but my intuition is that, you know, there's going to be psychopathologies, like the things that emerge, like psychological problems. There's relationships between them, and there's relationships between where they come from in terms of like how they relate to proper cognition or just the experience of cognition generally. And if we can map out, like Gabe's talking about, like an architecture of how that works in general, I think what's going to happen is what will emerge from that is a lot of explanatory power. We'll be able to explain all kinds of phenomena and start to make sense of them, almost like it's like a, almost like Gabe's working on like a hub of all kind of experiences. And if that hub can be mapped out, then we can start making sense of kind of a lot of things, you know? And so that's kind of my angle at this point. I feel like I was starting with, okay, how is it people heal? And where I was getting stuck was, well, I can't even describe reality. So like, I need to be able to describe reality first. And then, you know, and so when we met and it's like, oh, well, Gabe's like got this like description of reality that's like, okay, I don't even know what that means exactly, but I look at it and I'm compelled, you know?
Well, Karen, can I ask you, just having the conversation that we've had and looking over what I've sent you, what is your intuition and impression of what I'm doing? Like, how does it hit you on a more kind of subconscious, visceral, just what's the impression that you get? Because I am curious, because that'll help me kind of understand where you're coming from as well.
Well, I think part of what I need is I need more of a understructure to get a better grip on what you're doing. So I tried this time around to just focus on these four pages. There are four and a half pages that you recommended to me. And so I'm trying to see the system or the form that's kind of underlying it, because what you're doing here is considerably more granular than what most people do when they're looking at cognitive mapping, you know, like 4E cognition. That's a pretty simple system. There's these four things and you can explain each of them. I mean, I'm sure that people have doctorates in it. It's not that simple, but what you've done is considerably more getting down to the nooks and crannies of every single thing. But at the same time, it fits into some sort of larger pattern that you're working with. And I'm trying to get a grip on what that pattern is. Before I go there though, I will talk about that. Before I go there, I did want to ask something related to what Ryan was just saying. You know, the way they teach the new math nowadays is very, very confusing to students. Very much like when you were talking about the what do they call that booklet again they use in
the DSM.
The DSM. Okay. The DSM is just full of all these discrete things and how do they connect to each other and nobody knows. And that's kind of the way math is being taught nowadays, especially in the elementary and yeah, junior high schools. But the people that were doing Math Olympics, that were training their students to do math Olympics and go out and do competitive math, discovered that if they went back and got textbooks from 100 years ago and taught math to their students from those old textbooks, their kids were on top of it. They beat everybody else at the math Olympics. And I'm wondering if there isn't something similar in the psych world, because I remember when I was growing up and they first started having therapy and talking about that kind of thing, that they talked about order and disorder. There were things that were disordered in the human psyche that could be helped by a therapist. But nowadays they can't really talk about disorder, because then you might be making a judgment about whether somebody is fitting a certain category or not fitting a category. And I think it's the whole issue of judgment is the reason why they've separated everything out into these discrete issues now. But anyway, so I was wondering if there are old textbooks that a person could go back and look at that would give more insight into how this cognitive mapping might be perceived by past generations. Does that make sense as a question?
No, I think that's a great insight. Ryan, do you know, because I know you're studying those things, do you know something about that?
No, I don't know. I mean, I haven't done it for cognitive mapping, but I've done it for other stuff. So like the mind-body connection that I've been trying to understand, I found this really great work from not that long ago, but it's something that's fallen out of favor. But this lady was basically doing Gerda Alexander, maybe something like that. Her system was called Eutony, Eutony. And it's hard for me to even describe, but basically she was training people to just become deeply aware of their bodies and sensations. And she wasn't doing it through methods. It was through basically training people to just develop their own intuitions. And so she would have some very general methods, like have people, you know, have these long sticks and tap them on the floor and just do it for a long time and just feel everything that comes up and become aware of how you move and where the limits of your body are and stuff like that. And so it's a deeply like personal phenomenological thing, you know, which is polar opposite in some sense to the kind of prevailing way we do everything, you know? And I don't know if that quite answers your question or relates to what Gabe's talking about, but my sense is it's similar where, you know, Gabe talks about he's tracing the lines on the floor. I mean, it's all there to be discovered if we pay attention, you know?
Well, one researcher that I could point you to, and I only know what I know, which is a very tiny bit, but I know her name, and that's Barbara McClintock. And yeah, she has been mentioned by Perry Marshall and by Michael Levin and by, I believe, even John Verbeke, if I'm not mistaken. But she was doing research into plant evolution,
yeah,
back in the 50s or 60s. And the powers that be actually tried to discredit her work. But now it's widely accepted that her work was correct. And what she discovered was that the cells in the plant, if the plant gets in trouble for some reason, you know, environmental pollution or chemicals or something like that that's causing trouble to the plant, that the plant can actually signal a way of evolving some of its cells itself to bring about healing. So it's almost like an internal I just lost the word. When they're testing medication and they give the medication to one side and the other side they give a placebo. It's almost like the plants themselves can develop their own placebo effect without any additional medication or anything. The plant is designing its own response to its problem, but it's not a long-term evolutionary process. It's like almost instantaneous. So plants have this agentic capacity to help themselves. And that's at that level, down at the cell level. Well, okay, then that picture must exist at all these other levels too, the way that I think. I mean, you know, what do I know? But that's the way I see the world. So I'm seeing that, I'm thinking that that same thing exists at other levels. And a conversation that I had with Michael Levin and John Verbeke, where they were talking about this placebo effect one time. Levin, I believe, was the one who brought up this guy who was a researcher. I have to go back and look that one up, but he was actually working on healing people with very serious mental trauma. And he found some sort of a self-healing capacity in there that was, and that's why they brought up the Barbara McClintock thing. So there is some sort of a connection there, and I will go back and do a little research on that and see if I can find it in my previous episode. Because I actually, one of the guys actually had said, could you send me the other guy's research on this? And so I gathered the research and I sent it on. So I do have it someplace, but I hadn't thought about it until just now. So, and the Gerda Alexander thing kind of fits into that same category, I think. So I do think there is something there. I think if we go back into the older literature, I recently started reading, finally, I started reading some philosophy.
Nice.
Because I'm always talking with people about philosophy and listening, and I have no idea what they're talking about. So this is a series by Peter Kreeft, where he goes through all of philosophy in four volumes. So the first volume is the pre-Socratics, and then Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And I'm up to Socrates now. So I've been through all the pre-Socratics. And, you know, in many ways, there's just nothing new. Because
yeah.
All the things that are being talked about today and that are so controversial today and creating all the polarization and everything, those were the same ideas that they were dealing with back there. So that has been very good to read. And I'm sure that in the last 400, 500, 600 years, there's also been things about how to help people with some of these issues. So
that reminds me of one aspect of Gabe's work that, I mean, and Gabe, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm probably wrong, but like this notion of there's in the ways that we engage with reality or whatever we're perceiving, you know, there's this kind of like self-balancing thing that needs to happen where there's an oughtness to each aspect of this. And that oughtness can get kind of curved or twisted in one of two directions, which is very kind of like Platonic. I mean, I think it's Plato that talks about, and maybe the Republic or something, where it's like, you know, he frames virtues in that way, that virtue is there's a proper orientation to things. And, you know, like courage, you know, courage can either be cowardice or foolhardiness. And the proper orientation is this kind of balance between the two that are in tension with each other. You know, and so that notion of tension that you and Scott have talked about, Karen, is like, seems to play into Gabe's work somehow. And then it's like that tension, if you have proper tension in every area, that's going to lead to this sort of self-healing, self-balancing thing or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And even if you just think about like the words in scripture that are talking about righteousness and justice, and they all have to do with measurement. You know, when you justify something, you're bringing it up to the measurement. You're bringing it in line with something. Or when it's a just weight and measure, those are weights and measures that match up to the truth. Right. And, righteousness has this idea of something that is straight, that's lining up. So right. I do think that there is a way that the world is supposed to be. And or maybe there is a way that the world is, and we're somehow out of sync with it because of floating around in our own mess,
you know,
right?
If I can go back to what you mentioned about the plants, I kind of think of plants in a lot of ways, at least the ones that we haven't affected directly. They have a certain ordering to them, and so those expressions in response to what's happening are more ordered than perhaps with us humans, because we have more options in how we respond to the things that happen to us and the difficulty. So if the plant is damaged or under threat, it has a certain limited response that's built into it. Whereas I think when it gets to the level of human consciousness, you're dealing with a system that has far more options of so-called correction. And what we see today, or at least as I see it, and I feel like many, many of us do, is people are going back to the kind of the way things are medicated. It's I'm dealing with symptoms in a certain way, and I'm reinforcing certain areas in order to either limit or lessen the symptoms of what's going on in that area, or to hide it away entirely in matters of trauma or emotion. So it's almost like if you look at the pattern I've drawn, and you think of that as something that you wear on your chest or you carry with you, the more cleaned up and pure the cycle is, the more smoothly you move through it, and the better your ability to measure is. But the more you start patching things with artificial structures of what some form of medication or unhelpful practice or poor choice in relationships, and you start to try to make those adjustments outside of the way the system is designed to work, then you start to add on to it, and suddenly you have something that is out of balance. So if you think of balance as the measure of things, the balance between those vital tensions, as you add, suddenly your tool, your mechanism, however you'd like to qualify it, is no longer accurate. It's no longer dialed in a way that you can measure properly. So it's like having a ruler that's made of rubber, and you stretch it, and suddenly it's like you can still measure with it, but the measures aren't going to be accurate because you've pulled it out of its natural state. And so what you're seeing is no longer giving you a clear picture of what is. And as a result, you're making decisions and making changes based on poor information. So you see that in any sort of personal spiral. It generally, unless there's some serious intervention or correction or some serious work to kind of clean out what all is in there, then things tend to spiral down in a negative, destructive direction. And I just listened to an episode of Verbeke's podcast, and it was interesting. I forget who he was talking to, but the guy was walking him through kind of turning in on himself and talking to the different versions of himself. And it looked like a process of just kind of cleaning things out and rebuilding the relationships and rebalancing those tensions within himself. And I think when it comes, like I said, to the plant, it's very simple, and it's less likely without tampering that those things will go out of balance. But with us, we have the option of deciding how we respond, and we have many more options of avoiding the hard part, the hard work, which is usually generally the, what is it? Peterson always likes to talk about Jung saying, the thing you need most is in the place you least want to look. So so much of the time, instead of just going in and whether it's allowing Christ to do that surgery or making progress yourself and cleaning out those artificial structures that you've used resources to create, you continue to just add it on, and your perspective becomes more and more incoherent and out of touch with reality, because the system is no longer balanced. And it is that balance, that dialing in of the tool, that allows you to measure accurately. If that kind of hits on what you were saying.
Yeah, I have a thousand questions about that.
Go ahead, pick the one that comes first.
Well, I mean, the one that pops up doesn't have anything to do with your system necessarily, but let's say I'm one of those people that I've got all kinds of barnacles, and I mean, we all do, but I mean, let's say that I have so many barnacles that I just can't move ahead because I'm just covered with barnacles everywhere. And however the system is supposed to work, it just hangs up at every point, right? Is the idea that if you got it all right, that things would start rolling around again? Or in my mind, I mean, sometimes when I hear people talk about their coming to faith, the moment when they have this realization of who Christ is, it's as though they get this instantaneous download of wisdom and love and power and washing, and everything just clears out in an instant. And then the challenge becomes, how do you stay there? How do you stay in this new world where reality exists and not start putting barnacles back on again? Or is there a way where you could work your way through and take off one barnacle at a time if you just had enough information?
I definitely think both cases are possible. I think you can get to a place where with addiction and things like that, where you have to cry out for help. Because like you said, if you're so encrusted that you can't even move, at that point, the only thing you can do is cry out for help and hope someone comes along that will chip you, like help you clear out. And I think the way you described, like the people who receive Christ in that way, like those are the lucky ones. A lot of what I've seen and experienced in others and even in myself is it's kind of like he shows up and then starts the slow process of clearing those things out. Because so much like the download of wisdom is like, again, the lucky ones. Because what I think happens more often is the uncovering of the things is how he teaches you how that thing works. So it's like by scraping away what's not working, by scraping away what shouldn't be there, and allowing you to see what is there is the is a process that I see so many go through in learning how to operate in a healthy way. And then again, once you're there, the issue of staying there, it remains an open system. And so there are those pathways of like attracting barnacles or allowing them to come in. And so many times when people have those pathways ingrained, they don't notice it. The red flags don't go up. But after a repeated chipping away of the same barnacle, eventually it's like, okay, well, you plant that little red flag and suddenly you're aware. You're more aware of those things and you can recognize it when it comes. You recognize the patterns as it approaches. And so there's more of a warning, and that wisdom grows in how I can avoid allowing that to happen again. Because I've seen it in people close to me and in myself as well. Those pathways, once you turn to Christ, once you make a decision to make a serious change in your life, those pathways almost always, outside of supernatural healing, almost always remain. And you have to let them grow back over, and you have to carve new pathways, and that are pathways for healthy things to come in, healthy ways of responding to things. And so
could I frame this in terms of like my personal experience lately?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So like the stuff that Karen and I have talked about with my kind of personal healing and stuff, like I very much felt like, you know, like I really like that image you brought up from Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Karen, of like Eustace has become a dragon and he's covered in these scales. And that's kind of what we're talking about. It feels as if I was trying to be obedient to the outward things without dealing with those scales at all. So it's like I showed up at this new church as fully as that dragon. Because I knew, well, this is where I ought to be. This is, you know, there's something good here. But I'm, you know, but I don't have any hope. I'm not dealing with this stuff. And I so deeply wanted, yeah, Christ to just like do something in the center of me that would just explode it all out instantly. And it wasn't happening. It never happened, you know, it never worked that way. But what did start happening was, I mean, the first moment I actually had some hope for the future was when I was massaging stuff and I felt a little burning sensation here. And I was like, what is that? And so I kept doing that and trying to feel more of the burning sensation, and it hurt. But then when it was done, I could tell ever so slightly it's looser right there and it's a little more relaxed. And so I thought, huh, well, I hope I'm not damaging my body, but I'm going to keep doing this, you know? And so I started looking for where can I get more of that burning sensation. And what I realized eventually over hours and hours of doing this was, oh, I'm actually really loosening this way. And that was the hope. And it's almost like that hope got injected deeper and deeper into the system, where now it's this feedback loop where the hope started on the outside, it got injected deeper into the inside, which allowed it to then start spreading in more directions, if that makes sense. And so it was like this dialogue between outside in and inside out, you know, because what was happening on the outside was forming and shaping what was going on at the center. And the way I'm conceptualizing it is that you have an absolute center in some sense, and that's your core beliefs or your core identities or something. I don't quite know what that is, but they seem to be talking with each other, you know? And so if you start getting a little bit of hope here that gets down to the middle of the Death Star, that then it can start exploding the whole thing, you know? And I think that's how you can start to make sense of, you know, the slow iterative change, the clean your room thing, the start from the outside and deal and pull off the scales one by one. But that has some kind of transformative effect to the whole system. And that is a really powerful feedback loop, I think. Something like that.
Makes me
I
think of
think.
that verse, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for. So the things hoped for somehow become a substance, and then that substance is faith. So hope really is kind of the beginning of things.
It was for me. Where does hope fit into your system, Gabe?
I would agree with how hope has so much to do with how you aim your faith. Because I think every man and woman has a faith. I think of it as almost the orientation aimed at the goal, whatever your purpose is, and where you find that, you find it in your faith. And hope is, I think, a big part of how you orient that and how it things change as well, because the hope seems to be a guiding thing for faith, kind of a sensitivity to, because if it's kind of like if you're in a certain fork in the road in your life, metaphorically speaking, and you look down one road and you have an intuition and a sense of what things are going to be like, and it fills you with despair. But you look down the other road and you have a feeling of hope. So I think there's a certain deep level of communication that's going on, whether it's with your own intuition or some higher guiding power that uses hope almost as kind of the difference between pleasure and pain. And it's not a perfect, what's the term? Blanking on that analogy, not a perfect analogy, but just it seems to be one of the, like, if you think of it in terms of a sensory thing, it's one side of that particular sense, whatever that sense is the hopeful side, and the fearful or terrified. And you can have hope in the midst of that. So it's a difficult thing. As far as specifically where it is, I don't know. I've done some writing on it, but it's not mapped in there, because I think it is related to faith, which is kind of the center, the aiming thing. And the pattern that I've drawn is more the balancing aspect of it. And it only just touches on the aiming. And I think hope is related to the aiming of faith.
Well, so where aim shows up in the pages that you gave me is in the cycle of discovery. So maybe we could talk first about the cycle of discovery, since that seems to be a simpler segment or section of the thing. And it goes from hear to see to touch to smell to taste and then back to hear. So hear, see, touch, smell, taste. But each of those words has a unique perspective in your system. So hear is related to turn.
Yes.
But see is related to aim. So let's just take those two to start with. How do you see those? Why is hear related to turning and see related to aiming?
So the little realm between hear and turn is consciousness. So if you think of hearing, whether it's a piece of music or someone preaching the gospel or whatever doctrine that they're spreading or trying to spread, the hearing is linked to consciousness because you're made aware in that hearing. It comes to your awareness, and as a result of that excited awareness, in order to address that hearing, you turn towards it in the direction of it, and that's when look and see and aim follows. So as you hear, your consciousness decides how to respond to what is heard and turn towards or away from. And so that's why hearing and turning are closely related in that way.
So then you turn and look.
Yes.
And then you have a choice when you're looking of whether you're going to see or not see.
Yes. Because
looking doesn't necessarily include seeing, right?
Yeah. Yes.
I know I've done that. I've looked at something and not really seen it, so I know it's possible. So hearing is the first step, and it's really interesting because in the scripture, especially in the Old Testament, hearing is very closely related to obeying. The two words are, hearing is not translated obey, but oftentimes the word for obey is translated hearing. So those two words are very closely related. So the first thing we have to do is hear, and then we see. And then when we see, we aim. Or is aim a choice, or is that a natural outcome of seeing?
It's the choice lies in kind of the tensions between these parts of the cycle. So as you're seeing and then aiming, the choice lies kind of in your substance. So it's activating. You think you see, and then in order to aim, you have to activate your physical substance to focus on what it is you're aiming at. So the same thing with hearing and turning. You have to, your consciousness is activated, and you have a decision of broadening or narrowing your awareness in that moment, I feel like. And so if you choose to narrow it, it limits your ability to turn all the way to whatever it is that's caught your attention initially. But if you broaden it sufficiently, you can turn based on your broadened awareness, turn towards that thing. And then coming back to the aiming, it's a sort of narrowing back down and focusing. And you'll see that turn and aim are things that happen internally, whereas the senses are taking things out from the outside. What happens internally is the choosing whether how to turn, how far to turn, what to aim out, how carefully to aim, and whether or not to aim away in the other direction based on your response. So a lot of this has to do with me trying to understand what kind of freedom the individual has in making those adjustments and in navigating their world. Like, how does choice come into it? How do you So you see the turn, aim, grasp, test, eat. Those things are an internalization. It's something that goes on the inside of the person and then is transmitted outward based on the action that is taken.
Yeah, and the go ahead, Karen.
No, you go first.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the reason all this resonated so much with me when I first heard it was because I was working on a little project that was like literally a computer program that was trying to model a little amoeba that moves around and responds to information in the environment, right? And where I was stuck was like, how do you model that in a way that's not arbitrary? Like, how is it responding to information? Do I just program it to say, well, everything within 100 pixels, just look at that or whatever, you know? Those were the kinds of problems I was stuck on. And then when I heard Gabe's stuff, it's like, oh, this makes sense. And it's not something he just like made up randomly. It's like, okay, this is how I experience all information in the world. If my attention is currently here, the first thing that happens is something out of my current like perspective grabs my attention. And that has to happen through hearing because I'm looking over here, right? And so I hear something over here. And then I decide, am I going to engage with that or am I going to stay over here? So the choice is, okay, I'm going to turn, I'm going to pay attention to this, right? So now I'm oriented towards it. Now I look and I decide whether I'm going to truly see it or not, or if I'm just whatever, you know? And you can kind of imagine that whole cycle of how am I responding to information, moving towards it, taking it in, you know, doing something with it, processing it, and then expelling it. That is the cycle of how we are constantly engaging with all information at all levels of abstraction, right? And so that's the architecture, right? And it seems to be this constant back and forth between, you know, the senses are giving us information, and then we're processing it and deciding what to do with that, and then taking an action, right? And it's this cycle of, you know, no matter what information, it's always the same cycle of, you know, I become aware of it, I turn towards it, I move towards it, I don't know the order, but I examine it, I grasp it, I internalize it, I process it, I expel it, whatever, you know? And so it's like, that makes perfect sense to me as a very generic pattern of all interactions between two entities, right? And so now it's like, okay, that is a pattern I can latch onto for literally programming my little amoeba robot thing. Because it's like that has to be how an entity with agency is engaging with the world. Like it has to be, you know.
Very well put. Thank you.
Well, I'm wondering, have either of you looked at Carl Friston's work on
No, I have.
Well, maybe in the future we'll do another episode and I'll bring up some of Carl Friston and we'll talk about it, because he makes use of something that was not his own design. It's a pretty common thing in the whole world of, I want to say, Bayesian inferencing, which I don't understand well at all, but it's this thing called the Markov blanket. And a Markov blanket has to do with, well, if you just look at a Markov blanket, it just looks like a collection of little circles that are connected together in the way circles would connect together, where the two circles that are next to each other, you could consider the parents, and then the parents have a child, and that child also has two sets of grandparents on either side, and the whole circle is set up that way. So the Markov blanket is those circles that are sort of your boundary, protecting you from the outside world. That's your blanket. And then those are the ones that are right at the edge of the outside world. That's your sensory apparatus, sensing the world. And then there's sensory, and then there's active, and those are the parts of you that can touch the world, not just receive sensory information from the world, but touch the world, act back on it. So you have, because I notice on your program here that you have sensory and motor and interaction, as like these three categories? No, three.
Yes, what that is was kind of based on something Ryan and I were talking about in another conversation, as far as what it's going to look like for us to kind of recreate this at on a simple level digitally. So I was breaking it up into, so you have your sensory, like consciousness, the hearing, and then you have your motor, like a will, like moving in, looking, like turning towards and looking. And then there has to be another interaction there, because as you look, you think there's something going on. You're looking, so there's a light. There's some sort of light coming to you. So there's an interaction externally that has to happen. So it's that internalization and the sensory wise, and then the transmission of the sensory information into the motor context, and the decision in the motor context to take an action, and then the interaction that results from that action, which colors the next intake of sensory information. So it's cycling in that way. And I have I've heard only a little about the Markov blanket, and I think I want to make it clear here what I'm doing. I'm not necessarily trying to come up with something that's entirely new. So much of what I've done to develop this is testing myself against what other people are thinking and how other people are thinking about things. And I liked what you said about going back towards the older things, because things like Faraday is a big influence in how he looked at things, and Leibniz with his dynamism definitely interests me. So what I'm, if my pattern is correct and accurate to the extent that I'm able to make it, all of those things should find purchase somewhere within it. Mm-hmm. And the patterns should be similar. And so that Markov blanket example, I think, ties nicely with what I'm trying to do as well, because there is that flow of intake, and there has to be that transmission as well between, because I tend to just see the betweens of things. I have a hard time focusing on the things themselves. I see the I see the spaces between them, and that's kind of how my brain maps things. And so in between the sensory and the motor, it's like, well, what happens in that space? How do you transfer, and what does that information transfer look like from the sensory to the motor? Because they are separate in a sense, and they perform separate things, but they are similar and united and very closely knit as well. So what is that relationship look like? What is it that is happening in that transfer of that information? And so that's you kind of have to look at what I've done, because it's really easy to kind of focus on the units of each little thing. And what this is the space between all the units, because the units are there, but really the focus of it is what are the relationships between all of these things, and how do they interact?
That gets back to what Ryan brought up earlier about tension, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So each one of those like sets of circles is a tension. Like it is a balance. It's a, what's that term, tensegrity? Like there's the strength of the tension is what gives you your shape as a being, you know. And when those things are out of whack, if things are too loose, then the shape is lost, and the accuracy again of the measurement is going to be unreliable. If things are too tight, then the shape is constricted, and then you can't move between those things to actually make those adjustments, because everything is so bound so tightly. So that is absolutely fundamental to what I'm trying to do.
And then like you can take that pattern and you can apply it to basically anything, right? And so I think of like, okay, the experiences I've had with my body, you know, it's like frozen shoulder and this carpal tunnel stuff. It's essentially like, it feels like that. There was a proper oughtness to things that was well balanced. Everything was in perfect tension, you know, and then something happens and things shorten a little bit, or things, you know, the tension changes. Well, okay. The moment the tension changes, now it's out of balance, and just a little bit, but if you don't respond to that, if you don't deal with that, if you don't rebalance it, what's going to happen is it's going to have a compounding effect, right? You know, you get into these negative feedback loops, or what is it Verveke calls it? Like maybe like parasitic processing or something, where it's you kind of spiral down into
reciprocal
yeah,
narrowing.
That's the one. It's almost like this phenomenon of reciprocal narrowing is that like the thing is out of balance, and that leads to more out of balance and more out of balance. And then it's like to loosen it, you know, you have to start with something, but then that has a snowball effect, you know? And, you know, going back to your question from way earlier, Karen, like once someone has this healing experience through, you know, like through Christ, like how do they stay there? It's like, as the system becomes more what it ought to be, as long as you're continually paying attention, it's easier to stay in that tension. And especially the more awareness you have, because when you're aware of the tensions and when you know how to modify the tensions or heal the tensions or whatever the proper terminology is, then you can be constantly monitoring and balancing the whole system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could apply that to a body. You could apply that to a mind. You could apply it to an AI neural network. You can apply it to whatever is an information process, right?
So Gabe, you wanted to say something?
Oh, I think I lost the train of thought. I was listening to Ryan.
Well, to just tag on to what Ryan was talking about, I mean, Aaron, my bodywork guide, the thing that he always taught me was I had been going to a chiropractor for like 27 years because I had a problem. I had cracked my pelvis when I was 27 without even realizing that that's what I had done. But it got me in this pattern of seeing a chiropractor. And the chiropractor would get me lined up and I'd be good for a couple of weeks. And then things would start to fall over again. And then I'd have to go back to the chiropractor. And this had been going on for years. And Aaron said, well, that is just as though if you're looking at, say, the Golden Gate Bridge or any other bridge that has these big girders and all this stuff holding things together, if you knock a few of the bricks out, you can push them back into place. But when you knock them out, the tension on the wires going either way is going to get off. And so you can push the bricks back into place, but the tension is still off. So if you don't balance the tension, it doesn't matter how many times you put the bricks back into place, you're going to be off. So if your spine is a bunch of bricks lined up with all your, you know, your spinal cord, your vertebrae, when those vertebrae get out of alignment, as Ryan was saying, things get out of balance and the tension builds up on one side or on the other side. And if you don't fix the tension, it's continually going to be pulled out of place. And
if the muscles,
I think that's, go ahead.
If the muscles like shortened on one side because of a chronic poor posture, like that shortness is not going to heal as quickly or correct as quickly as popping the spine back into alignment. So it's like that with the source of tension has to be addressed. And you can look at each one of these 10 tensions. It's like, okay, well, what is the body is very near to us and very, very present in a lot of ways, more so than anything else. And so it's really easy to kind of identify like where those tensions are. But in the other aspects of like, okay, what is tension and form, you know, between masculine and feminine aspects of the individual? What is a tension in intercourse between whether it's interacting with someone or a sexual relationship where you're producing children? Like what are the tensions there? What's the tension in morality between mercy and justice? That dichotomy, how are those balanced? Too much mercy and you end up with lawlessness, too much justice and you end up with contempt. So there's a system of extremes that these things fall out into when the thing is not balanced. So you can look at each one of these things as you would your body, but it's a different aspect of your being. So just as much as you are a body, you are also a moral creature. Just as much as you are a moral creature, you're also a creature of values. You are a creature who lives in reality. So as you reality be the being the measuring aspect. So it's if your measuring aspect is out of balance, your ability to make proper measurement is ineffective. And so that's kind of how it would be. You, just as much as you think of your body as a system of balanced tensions, like every aspect of your being is a system of balanced tensions, as I see it.
That makes me think about, you know, my own little pet theory about how underneath the laws of physics, there are these interactions that are made possible by, I never know what to call it, but imagine it's a system of guy wires or something along which things can happen. That's not exactly right either. But the idea is, let's take one of you were talking about the balance between, say, mercy and justice. That's going to be a different balance depending on every context that you run into.
Yes, absolutely. Right?
So that's exactly what happens when you're painting a painting. Every stroke is going to require a different kind of balance, balancing the intensity, balancing the temperature, balancing the hue, balancing the texture. Every single one of those is going to be a different balance depending on the context, when the stroke goes down, how often something is going to be repeated, or whether the repetition is identical or non-identical, is going to be different in every context. And the not only the context of what the painting is intended to be, but the context of how to produce the most beauty in that, even in every inch of the work, not even just the whole thing, but every inch of the work has to have this beauty to it. So repetition, variation, gradation, balance, every one of these things is, I guess the word balance works in all of these, because it's with gradation, what's going to be the balance? How much gradation? Every situation is going to be different. And this is why I think that underneath the laws of physics, there has to be something like that, where all these, maybe the word tension is correct, where all these tensions are possible. There's a space of possibility, but that possibility has to be guided by the proper balance of everything for the particular context. Because wherever a particle is in the universe, it's in a unique context from all the other places in the universe. And so it's going to react differently to all the forces around it. And that has to be part of how things are put together. Does that make any sense?
No, absolutely. I think you've hit it on the head precisely. It's almost like the wisdom of the particles is inbuilt into them. And so if you think of morality, stepping back to that, the smell of things, whether it smells right or wrong, I always metaphorically and just the way people think of it, it's like that doesn't smell quite right. It's kind of a intuition, but it's that input of something coming in that strikes. So think of a spinning top spinning, and then you bump it and it starts to precess. And to the extent that you bump it, the precession can be minor or extreme. And so what you're dealing with is the system is dynamic in that way. So when there is a certain input, they're based on the state of the measuring device, you get an accurate sense of how extreme that input in. So you think of someone who's very robust and learned very much and grown very much. And so certain things come in and it's very minor perturbation, but someone who's very sensitive and traumatized and hasn't taken the time to deal with things and grow, that same input can throw it out of balance in a very serious way. So the subtlety of making the decision is based on the perturbation. So as the input comes in, what is being responded to is how it is affecting that system. And so the issue of mercy of justice is like, okay, the example I used at one point in one of my writings is if a child is learning to drink from a cup and soils his shirt, like that by nature requires a certain amount of mercy. So the input is the frustration of dealing with this child that is soiling a shirt that you're going to have to wash. But the appropriate response is mercy, because there's this process of learning that's going on. Now you have your teenager who knows how to use a cup and deliberately dumps it on their shirt. So the reality of that frustration is one that is likely to require, or I would say requires, justice at that point. So it's the same circumstance, but again, a different context, and how that input upsets the system based on the context that it's in. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And I think, and I read through your paper that you sent me, and I have been thinking about those things as almost perhaps a scaling of measuring that system out of balance. Cause I have that to a certain degree, but as far as the specifics, I think there's further study that can be done about that, and integrating those different aspects of balancing, those different aspects of measuring in each aspect of who, like whatever it is you're measuring at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the therapist in me is deeply interested in that idea because, you know, a helpful paradigm shift for me was when I realized, like, when I started thinking of things in terms of information processing. It's like, I can't just say that because X event happened, it therefore had Y effect. Like, yeah. That's a very naive perspective of things, because that event, my perception of that event is being filtered through my whole system and is going to have certain effects, you know? I mean, down to, you could come up with goofy examples, but like, if I walk outside and it's cold, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? It entirely depends on how I'm processing that information. You know, if it's been blazing hot every day for the past month, and then I have a cold day, like, oh, that's refreshing, you know, and vice versa. Or on a deeper emotional level, you know, I might walk outside and the cold reminds me of my childhood where I felt, you know, sad, impoverished, and the cold makes me think of all these, you know, sad things. Well, it'll have that kind of effect, right? Or you know, it might remind someone of their happy childhood and winters with family, you know, all this. So it's like, we are constantly processing information, and the effect it has on our system is dependent on the current state of the system. It's not nearly as, I don't want to say not objective, but like it does depend on where is the system at, how much is that top spinning currently, right?
Yeah. And if you look
initial
at the section,
conditions, I mean, you know, initial conditions determine everything. I think when people use that phrase, they're typically thinking of, you know, just, you know, what's the temperature and what's the wind force, and, you know, the butterfly in Brazil, is it going to make a monsoon in the, you know, Far East or something like that. But initial conditions, as you were describing them, Ryan, there's so many. You only gave a couple of them. There's probably 150 initial conditions that are affected when you have any experience in life. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. And so the work of, you know, like the work of helping people in a therapy setting or a therapeutic setting is going to require deep awareness of what is the current state of that system. You can't just say, well, because this happened, therefore we should apply this thing. You know, in my opinion, that's one of my big critiques of like that whole DSM mindset, and even to an extent, a critique of kind of the evidence-based paradigm right now. It's great that we're trying to measure those things, and that's good. But like, effectiveness of treatments or effectiveness of anything is going to depend on the system itself, right? And I think the only way to dance that dance well is through deep awareness, you know? And it can't just be me from the outside being aware of you. It's like you have to develop your own deep internal awareness. And the more you do that, the more you're going to be able to start rebalancing and feeling and sensing, like, okay, you know, on a physical, emotional level, spiritual level, everything, you know, even down to when I'm acting as a programmer, the same patterns emerge. I'm balancing the massive code base. I'm balancing different aspects of the architecture, you know, and the more aware I am, And the more I'm reflecting on that and sensing it, the better those outcomes are going to be. Mm-hmm. Right.
And that touches on what you were talking about with the order of things. And I kind of see that as important, because you think if it's suddenly you're made aware of something, what is mm-hmm. required of you in order to make a change is movement. Like, so you are aware, you have to move and mm-hmm. you have to act and you have to make decisions in order to measure what is real. Because if you think of the collapsing the waveform when you take a measurement in physics, in order to take a measurement, you have to actually interact with the thing. So that awareness is not sufficient. It requires action in order to adjust perception and evaluate reality. So when you see in that cycle, you see the order of things as is necessary in order to update your awareness. So it's like, I have this awareness of the state of things as now, but it's limited because I can only see so far. So in order to expand on that, I have to take action and I have to move into a space and I have to see what kind of input I get as a result. And I have to react according to that to try to start to orient myself. Because if you're in the darkness of a depression or addiction, it requires movement in order to recognize where you are and what it is that has brought you to that space and what it are that are the influences that are holding you back from making progress and who it is that you need to reach out to. So the awareness is just the beginning of the thing. And I think that's why it's number one on my cycle or my model. It's just because it's not my cycle, I don't think. the awareness is just the beginning, and it requires, again, going back to that idea of Karen that you brought up of obedience. It's like hearing requires obedience by nature in order. Because if you do not move as a result of hearing something, like there is no obedience, there is no growth, there is no change. Something has to happen in order for you to reorient in that way.
So I think I have an idea of how we could move forward with this if we want to, because obviously it's not something that can be done in an hour. But I'm wondering if we could just, like, you have 10, is it 10 petals?
Yeah.
Okay. If we could take one of them each time and talk about it through a lens kind of like this, where we personalize it a little bit more, like maybe, Gabe, you could tell it in terms of a story or an analogy or a narrative and how it fits in that narrative. And then Ryan, you could work with that in terms of the healing side of the physical and mental on the healing side. That would help me a lot to work my way through it, because for me to look at the whole thing at once is really overwhelming. And I'm having I can look at it, but when I look at it, it's just a system. It's just words. But you're talking about something that's far more deeply personal and powerful than just a system made up of words. So I think if we tackled it that way, we could, you know, maybe get together a couple times a month and just take one aspect of it each time and talk our way through it. Does that sound good?
Oh, I would love that. And that really touches on, I think, what Ryan and I are starting to work together on, is because you said, like you said, and this has been my experience in trying to share it with anybody, is it is very overwhelming. And it's took me 13 years to get to this place. So I can't imagine just all of a sudden coming upon that and trying to absorb it all at once. So I would love that. But what Ryan and I are kind of leaning towards working is like, how do we turn this into, like you said, a narrative that you can interact with? Mm-hmm. How can we make it a story that you can step into? So it's almost like the way I see it, and I know Ryan has his views as well, is like a video game. When you come into it, you skin your character. So the idea would be is you want to skin this character as accurately as possible with yourself, and you can walk it through these different scenarios and situations, and you can make those adjustments to the system to see how it responds. So making it something that's more tangible and interactive and has that narrative strength mm-hmm. of of making it clear in a way that is very deeply intuitive.
This is great. This is absolutely great. I love that. You know, I mean, we've seen something somewhat similar to this in the movie Inside Out.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that movie?
I have.
Have you seen it, Ryan? Yeah.
Yeah, really.
In that it tackled some of these tough emotional triggers and issues that people face, and, you know, looking at the kind of inside of the psyche, you know, but doing it in a way that makes it very graspable by people. But I really like this idea of whether you turn it into a game or not a game, but to have a narrative, a through line that goes through, where it's one story that takes you from one point to the next, so that you can, then you could hold on. Because let's say we did this one at a time, and we do each thing one time and talk about it. We talk about it deeply, but the time we get together for the next time around, we'll have forgotten about number two by the time we move on to number three, you know. But if you make it a story, then that it'll be cohesive all the way through, and you'll be able to hold on to the ideas as you move from one end to the other.
Yeah.
So I think that's terrific.
Yeah.
I do have to go here, but is there any last little bit that either one of you wanted to say?
No, I just really appreciate you having me back on, and I appreciate you coming back to it, because a lot of my experience has been people just kind of like, this is a lot and I'm just not going to think about it. But that's not the kind of person you are. I appreciate how curious you are, and the deep desire to know and to understand and to integrate those things in your own life. So I'm really enjoying being back here, and I'm grateful. So thank you.
Thank you. Ryan, do you have a last word? Oh, you could say, are you guys still having Estuary? Is it a regular meeting? Is there a day and time if there's people that are in the Dallas or maybe even the Waco area that would want to try?
Yes, we're currently doing every other Monday, 5 to 7 p.m. So you'd have to reach out to figure out which Monday it is specifically. But it's in Irving, which is relatively central for the DFW Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. So you can reach me at superegonaut@gmail.com and just reach out, and I'd be happy to give you the Discord server link or just give you the information you need so that you can come. So if there's anybody out there who's interested, we'd absolutely love to have you. And like Ryan said, it's a great group of guys, and it's very alien to me in a wonderful way to walk into a space and sit down and suddenly the conversations just flow, because we're all just steeped in that same variety of information that we all appreciate and enjoy. So it's a wonderful experience, and we'd love to have anybody who's interested come along and join us.
Great. I'll put that email. Is it okay if I put that email in the description section?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you guys. Have a wonderful week. We'll talk to you soon. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Karen.
Bye-bye.
Sounds good. Bye.